Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
And we thank you again, Audrey. How could we do this without you? You got us on the show one more time. What is it, 6,235 shows? No, it just seems like that, but thank you very much. Audrey, you know that somebody asked me last week where you found all those blonde jokes, and I told him, listen, I said, you have been on the internet. Al Gore invented it, and you were the first person to go up online. Am I correct? Right. Thank you very much, Audrey. We're kidding, of course. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining the Jumble Justice Radio Show. We do this every Thursday night from 9 to 10 p.m. We're in the premium show category. I'm not exactly sure what that means, other than it cost me a few dollars. if you go later or earlier, it doesn't. Johnny Cash, we want to thank you for taking us across the country and those 90 cities and states. How in the world could somebody sing that and remember all of those? And John, I'm going to give you a little tip. If you're hitchhiking tonight and your truck friend's going through Detroit City, you better be a little bit careful. I'll have something to say about that later on. Emily, Mike, thank you very much for doing this. Mike, thanks for joining or gathering up some new show stuff for us. And the purpose of the show, we look at criminal justice, we look at the news issues and events that surround that field. That means we try to dedicate our show to those energetic and tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and throughout the world. Yes, some of our justice agents, federal and state, once in a while, do work outside of the borders of the United States. What we try to do is look inside criminal justice and up close at these professionals as they perform their difficult and enjoyable practice, I might add. If you're listening on Blog Talk Radio, it's still unbelievable. You, for nothing, you can have a show set up in 15 minutes, and you can probably be broadcasting the same day and broadcast worldwide to 12 or 12,000 listeners. It doesn't make much difference, and it doesn't cost you one penny. So any one of you, any interest group, anybody, can have a show, and they can do it streaming audio live over the Internet. And these young people should be doing that. I don't know if they, you know, I've been following, that's wrong, I shouldn't say young people, but I have been following, because they're more characteristic of it, I've been paying attention to the tweeters and older people and sending text messages and working with their cell phones. And I noticed, I think I mentioned last week, two that were hugging each other, and their arm around the back of the other, they each had their cell phone out, and their thumbs were jumping, and they were actually text messaging. Well, this week I saw a woman run right into a door. She thought the door was completely open, but it was half closed, and somebody had set the little peg down on the bottom, and the door was closed. She walked right into that, and then I saw someone else, really hard to do. I don't think I could do it. Could you do it, Mike? Could you go to a drinking fountain, get a drink, and continue to text? She actually did that. She kept texting while she was drinking water. I've seen them in other places. I won't comment about that, but just incredible that somebody can do that. And, of course, you do this from your cell phone. So if you're used to texting and you want to show what you broadcast worldwide and you don't want to do it in 144 characters, you could actually have a show. All right, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news tonight and come up with a the page. And I'm going to start with one that indeed makes me sad. And, I must say that. And this was a headline in a couple places here the other day. As soon as it comes up, yes, there it comes. I feel so sad for the city, the people, and how they've been gypped in many ways. Much of it, of course, is their fault. But the illiteracy rate in the city of Detroit, would you take a guess? I mean, someone take a guess. 47% of Detroiters are functionally illiterate. Can you believe that? Only 53% of the people in the state can actually are functionally literate. Can you believe that? Can you imagine a school superintendent going back 5, 6, 7 appointments, whatever it is? These people ought to publicly sacrifice themselves because of that blunder. Man, they talked to all these people and they found out they're not able to fill out basic forms for getting a job. This means that they can't be corrections, parole officers, police officers. My gosh, they don't stand a chance. And it's got nothing to do with general intelligence. It's got to do with the way they were taught and the discipline they were provided in the school system. Just think about that. They can't do the basic, one of the comments is they can't do the basic tasks. Some of Detroit's suburbs also have high numbers of functional illiteracy. 34% of people in Pontiac, Michigan, and 24% in Southfield. For other urban areas, we're a little bit on the high side. We compare slightly higher to Washington, D.C.'s urban population in certain zip code areas than in Cleveland, she said. And she is, let me see, she spoke with the fund's director, Regional Workforce Fund director. But how in the world could something like that, could that be? I mean, that is as shameful as anybody could get in terms of the education system. I'm sure not every person was brought up and trained in Detroit, but to think that we can go out into farm communities where all these kids graduate reading out in the middle of nowhere in a city, which is a fine city in many ways. Other ways, it's not so good. But anyway, there's an opening there for somebody to go and teach them how to read, I would think. Absolutely incredible. This one I thought you would enjoy this evening as soon as it pops up. Illinois has decided, Governor Pat Quinn and the state lawmakers cast Illinois as a sympathetic voice in the nation's volatile immigration debate with two actions that run counter to a wave of pro-enforcement measures approved under consideration in Arizona and other states. Quinn's office on Wednesday, can you believe it, sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security declaring that the state's formal withdrawal from secure communities, that's a federal deportation program that targets hardened criminals, that has also been used against illegal immigrants arrested for misdemeanors. They don't want any part of that. If you're just a misdemeanor offended or you get caught illegally in the state, they don't like the rush deportation that's been going on. Nearly a third of illegal immigrants deported out of Illinois under the program have never been convicted of any crime. That doesn't mean they didn't do one. It just means they didn't charge them. They just probably gave them the choice, like a plea bargain or something, I'm guessing. And citing federal immigration and customs enforcement data, Quinn's office suspended the state role in the program in November amid concerns about its effectiveness. It sounds like it was kind of effective, doesn't it? Can you believe that? The state decides they wouldn't do that. And very closely related is another story. Big Sis, Janet Napolitano, our director of Homeland Security, She's saying that the way we measure our effectiveness of securing the border is obsolete. Remember the Government Accountability Office came out here not too long ago and saying that less than half of the southern border is under operational control. It was less than that. It was like 29% or something like that. Well, she said that that operational measure is obsolete. Homeland Security Chief says he told Congress, we're trying to come up with a new yardstick to better reflect the improvements it has made. In other words, the measurement we're using doesn't give us the positive look that we want, so we're going to change the measure so we look better. Well, at least that would be one interpretation. But operational control, she says, is an archaic term. Yeah, I suppose it is. You know, words do matter. The word no can mean 28 different things, even yes, given the way it might be used sometimes, then she could be right. She said it's more than just a semantic game. But she's saying that we're not measuring this right, that they're really doing a lot better. Well, maybe she could ask the Washington, D.C. school district. They're good at making rapid improvements in their scoring and measurements. Remember I talked about that in the news show last week or the week before? Where they had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of school competency tests where people changed the answers from wrong answer to right answer, and not one time was it from a wrong answer to a second wrong answer. Wonder what that was all about. Also closely related to immigration, a topic that I'm fond of studying. The highest court of the European Union, I love the EU, ruled that member states may not jail immigrants who enter their countries illegally and then refuse to leave. Did you hear what I said? Are we next? The highest court of the European Union ruled that member states may not jail immigrants who enter their countries illegally and then refuse to leave. Absolutely incredible. The court ruled in the case of Hassan El-Dridri, an Algerian without papers whom Italy ordered to leave in 2004 and again in 2010, they said they can't make him leave. So they're stuck with him in Italy. And Italy's getting a lot of spillover from all the problems in the Mideast. How many countries are we in now fighting and bombing and doing drone attacks on? We just did a drone attack today or yesterday in Yemen, and we hadn't done that in like 10 years. So let me see, that's Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan. We're kind of busy, right? I mean, sounds like everybody will be employed in the Army of Special Forces here very shortly. But the Italians are not happy about this, as you can imagine. But that is just something. You want to hear another sad story? This is a night for sad ones. There's a guy who was out having fun with a bunch of his friends who were all deaf in a bar in Florida. And they were, of course, signing with each other. You know, sign language? So she sees them signing, and she thinks, she's a 45-year-old woman, and Barbara Lee is her name, she thinks that they're singing her gang symbols, and she's a member of a gang. And she thought this was like an opposing gang saying nasty things to her. So she leaves the bar, returns with two members of her crew, 18-year-old Marco Ibanez and 17-year-old, who they won't name, why not? But anyway, Ibanez pulls out a knife and begins stabbing Stewart and his friends, and they actually kill Mr. Alfred Stewart. Do you know why? These gang members thought that the deaf people were sending them gang signs, yet the deaf people were communicating with each other. I mean, talk about dopes and a story that has a very sad ending. She says there's no way ever, this is the mother of Mr. Stewart, that he was ever making any type of gang signs. She says he only does sign language. That's the way all of them do. That's the way they communicate, of course. But can you imagine a zip like that, doing stuff like that? Here's one last story, and then we'll have Audrey Taylor Bonjo. Here's a woman, 91 years old, in Los Angeles. Like a lot of grandmothers, she likes to keep busy. But while some grannies sit and knit scarves and afghans, I'd say that's a little ageist in opinion there, but anyway, this 91-year-old has a decidedly different hobby. She makes suicide masks. Have you heard about that? Charlotte started making these masks and selling them, these suicide kits, out of her cozy Southern California home after watching her husband die a slow and painful death from colon cancer. She blames doctors for keeping him alive. So she sells this little kit for $60 and she's demonstrated how they work. And to die with helium just takes you a couple of minutes and you're gone, she says. I don't know what California's going to actually do about that. I assume that's legal. Well, I don't know. Opponents of changing the law point to one of Charlotte's clients, a 29-year-old Oregon native. He wasn't suffering from a terminal illness. He opted out because he was tired of dealing with chronic depression. His suicide touched off a major controversy about that. So, boy, isn't that something? Well, Audrey, you've got a blonde joke for us tonight. I like this one. It's about one of our public service branches, correct? Go ahead. Let's hear it.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke for tonight is one that we can find humor in, but it could be tragic for the blonde. Say that, and I'm smiling, of course, since it is a joke. Here it is. A blonde comes home from a day of shopping and discovers that her house is on fire. So she calls the fire department on her cell phone. Please state the nature of your emergency, says the operator. Help. My house is on fire, the blonde replies. Okay, where do you live? In a house, you silly Billy, the blonde replies. No. How do we get there? The operator asks frustratedly. Use the big red truck, dummy.
Folks, I got to go back to one more news story here I missed, and this one is almost too much. You know, we've got border security, we've got smuggling, we've got, child trafficking, we've got everything going on in the whole wide world here, much of it in the United States, and serious problems, and the federal agents have been conducting for 1 year a sting operation, including aliases, a 5 a.m. surprise and surreptitious purchases from Amish farms in Pennsylvania culminated in the federal government announcing this week it has gone to court to stop Rainbow Acre Farms from selling its contraband. Its contraband is milk. They're selling unpasteurized milk. And they've been working undercover on this for 1 year. I want to put a price tag on that. And they're saying this pasteurized milk is against the law, and some people think it's more healthy because the pasteurization takes things out of there. But others say it can carry harmful bacteria such as Salmonella, E. coli, and Listeria. I think people drank milk a long time without pasteurizing it, didn't they? But anyway, but in this world of serious problems where we're fighting in five or six or seven different countries, you count them. I don't think I have enough fingers left on two hands to do that. But now we've been working 1 year on the Amish and undercover operations. I just love it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to bring back William Scheuer. That's how he pronounces his name. And William Scheuer, by the way, is the author of the book Osama Bin Laden. And I don't have time enough to talk about this story because everybody else in the world has commented on it. And what version are we into now? Version 13? I'll just give you some of the stuff. Like there were cameras, there were pictures, there were not pictures. We had pictures. There are these head cameras and, you know, on and on and on. But if you look at the bodies that some of those people have been shot, it doesn't look like somebody was shot 7, 8, 9 yards across a room or something like that. It looks like, you know, that somebody was up close. Executed. I don't know what about this. And of course, this will never go away until there is some type of proof. Even if photographs come out, we won't know. Of course, the incredible part of the story is that Osama bin Laden lived in this $1 million enclave right next to all kinds of people, and I guess 1,000 yards from Pakistan's military academy. I won't go on and on because you've heard about it probably almost ad nauseum, but people are playing this politically, and I mean all kinds of perspectives on it. But there'll be more come out, I'm sure, this week, and it's coming out almost by the hour now. So it's going to be interesting. New York Times is critical of this whole thing this morning, which is something they don't do very often. Well, give me time here to set up. Michael Schur, we're using the old-fashioned technology here tonight. So hold on just a second. Okay, this is Michael Schur. He was a CIA head of the Osama bin Laden unit for 2 years, and then when he left, he worked as a consultant to the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. And I think you will enjoy hearing him talk in light of course, this precedes the Sunday night, Sunday morning shooting in the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. But here we go with Michael Schur. I think.
Michael Schur, former head of the bin Laden unit at the CIA, talks about Osama bin Laden, his war against the United States 10 years after 9/11. Mr. Schur spoke about his book at the Philadelphia Free Library.
Good evening, everyone. I think it's perhaps a troubling time to be talking about the subject, the events of the day, of the past month, perhaps 6 weeks. Requires us all, I think, to rethink how we stand in the Middle East. So tonight I'd like to talk about the three threats to the United States that emanate from the Persian Gulf, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and what I call Al-Qaeda. In speaking tonight about the Persian Gulf and our war against Islam, against the Islamist militancy emanating from there, I want to start with words George Washington used to describe the new national government's responsibility to ensure that Americans clearly understand the threats they face at home and abroad. I am sure that the mass of citizens of these United States mean well, Washington told John Jay in 1796, and I believe that they will always act well whenever they can obtain a right understanding of matters. Let me say that I share Washington's faith in the essentially sound common sense of Americans, except perhaps that of the generation, whose male members seem unable to figure out how to put a baseball cap on so the brim points forward. But I am not sanguine that our national government, under either party, is capable or even desirous of accurately educating the citizenry about the Islamist threat confronting America. Today, Americans simply do not have what Washington called a right understanding of the threats from the Persian Gulf region. In my writings, I have sought to acquaint Americans with the nature of these threats, whether from Iran and its co-religionists in Iraq and Lebanon, the vicious, martial, anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, and anti-Western brand of Islamic theology exported under Saudi Arabia's official imprimatur, or the forces Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and other Sunni Islamists lead and incite. And I also argue that the United States government under both parties is fighting an Islamist enemy that does not exist. And therefore, it is employing policies that run counter to America's historical traditions, and so to its best interests. Official Washington's Islamic enemy is the stuff of Hollywood farce. Be they Shia or Sunni, the Islamists are a limited band of fanatic nihilists, ready to kill widely and indiscriminately for the pure joy of murdering, and ready to sacrifice their lives because my daughters go to university, Iowans hold early presidential primaries every 4 years, and because I, may God forgive me, have one or more Sam Adams after work. Would that such an enemy existed? For he would be at most a lethal nuisance and not the national security threat posed today to lesser or greater degree by Iran, the Saudis' Islamic imperialism, and the Sunni Islamist movement symbolized and inspired by Osama bin Laden. This farcical view of America's Islamist enemy is unfortunately endemic in both U.S. political parties, much of the U.S. and Western media, and perhaps most damaging, much of the academy, especially in our most prestigious universities. It is in my judgment that this view is almost entirely without substantiation, and if it continues to be Washington's working assumption, America will slowly but surely be defeated through the loss of prestige, blood, financial solvency, and domestic political cohesion. We will lose not because any of these threats are stronger than we are. That certainly is not the case. America's myopic governing elite and its media acolytes have taken enemies who are each in military capability, at most a puny 5 foot tall, even in jackbooted sandals, and made them into 10 foot tall and still growing behemoths. The three threats I'm going to speak about are those posed by Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Al-Qaeda and its allies. Taking these three threats, each of which is based in the Persian Gulf, let us first look at the smallest, least threatening threat, that which comes from Iran. Since our Tehran embassy was seized in 1979 and America was humiliated for more than 400 days, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been the bete noir of the bipartisan U.S. governing elite. The hostage holding created a hatred for Iran among ordinary Americans that is easily exploited by U.S. politicians, journalists, academics, and pro-Israel organizations. So successful have these scaremongers been in hyping what they often call a Nazi-like Iranian threat, in fact, that in all of American history, there probably has not been a non-threat like Iran that has been more feared by the average American. Look at Iran and what you see. First, we see a relatively small island of Shia Muslims surrounded by a Sunni world that despises them and would rather kill them than all the Americans, Britons, or Israelis they can get their hands on. Second, we see an Iran that in the last decade has been virtually surrounded by U.S. military bases and knows that its access to the high seas can be shut almost instantly by the U.S. Navy. And third, we see an Iran whose energy production has peaked and, with the economy it supports, is steadily declining. In Cold War terms, then, Iran is fully contained by opposing powers. But then again, so was Iraq, and that did not stop an unnecessary, disastrous war. Ah, you might say, but what if Iran gets a nuclear weapon? My answer is there is no if about it. Iran will get a nuclear capability. If we had been serious about stopping it, we would have stopped our European allies from selling Iran the necessary elementary technology in the 1990s. The Iranian leadership, moreover, has heard nothing from Washington, Israel, and much of NATO for the past 20 years, except threats of regime change and preemptive strikes, has experienced little but the reality of UN sanctions, and most recently has seen more than 400 U.S. congressmen and senators turning on their own president by standing and cheering a 2010 speech in Washington by Benjamin Netanyahu calling for war in Iran, on Iran. It has also seen, as we're seeing today in Egypt, Western governments encourage their nice, safe, and politically naive college students to Twitter young Iranians to urge a political revolution without a care about how many of those Iranians would die in the streets as a result. Given this context, in terms of political reality, Iran's leaders would be truly negligent if they were not seeking an effective defense against the constant threats from the world's most militarily potent nations. So Tehran will certainly get a nuclear weapon. But then what? Well, my response would be to ask, so what? Iran does not have the ability to hit the United States with such a weapon, while we certainly can incinerate Persia. And the Shias will not supply it to Sunni extremists who would be more likely to use it against Iran than against the West. But will they not use it against Israel, you ask? And I would say only if Iranian leaders are the most stupid men and women Allah ever created. Israel possesses a large, multifaceted, and wholly unaccounted for WMD arsenal, and it would surely use it if Tehran looked like it was even remotely thinking about a first strike. Indeed, Iran's acquisition of nuclear weapons still leaves it Shia island surrounded by hostile Sunnis, U.S. military bases, and U.S. and Israeli nuclear targeteers focused squarely on it. In other words, with or without a nuclear weapon, Iran is contained. It can continue to dabble with its violent surrogates in the Israel-Muslim religious war, but it cannot pose a military threat to the United States. Before moving to our so-called Saudi friends, let me say that there is one serious Iranian threat to the United States, but only if we and or the Israelis strike Iran first. Thanks to more than 35 years of near criminal negligence by the U.S. executive and legislative branches in the areas of border control and domestic security, both Iran and its Lebanese Hezbollah surrogate have created a large clandestine infrastructure in the continental United States, one which works with similar networks in Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean. The Iranians are too smart and too afraid of U.S. military power to use this network to strike first in America. But it clearly is designed to allow Tehran to respond with violence here if Iran is attacked by the United States or by our Israeli allies. Now for Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf Arab tyrannies that govern the states adjacent to what we too often forget is referred to by the Sunni world as the Arabian Gulf. Let me first say that I view Saudi Arabia, and to a lesser degree its fellow Arab Peninsula tyrannies, as the nation state that is perhaps the most dangerous to the United States and to the West generally. Yes, Russia and China are threats to the United States, but they are threats Washington openly acknowledges, closely watches and assesses, and is fully capable of defending America against. Saudi Arabia, however, is a serious threat, indeed one more dangerous than Iran, toward which our governing elite in both parties turns a blind eye. Our elite deceitfully pretends that Riyadh is a close and reliable ally. It keeps America's energy security dependent on its enemies by relying on the Saudis to play a pro-U.S. role in the world oil market. And it endangers our economy by allowing the Saudis to buy an ever larger share of our ever more out of control federal debt. In addition, the Saudis over the past 30 years have built a highly effective lobby in the United States, which is as pernicious, effective, and corrupting as IPAC, but more quiet and subtle. This lobby employs former U.S. ambassadors, generals, and senior intelligence officers to argue its case in the White House, the Congress, and the media, and especially in the Wall Street Journal. And needless to say, this lobby's work is enthusiastically assisted by our oil and arms-making corporations, whose concerns have less to do with U.S. security than in making sure they keep their seats on the Saudi gravy train that is even now hauling away another $60 billion worth of U.S.-made arms. Due to these factors, U.S. leaders never tell Americans the truth about the kingdom, which is that since the 1970s oil boom started an enormous transfer of Western wealth to the peninsula, the Saudis have quietly exported a brand of Sunni Islam that has radicalized much of the historically defined Sunni Middle East region, and which is now Arabizing Muslim populations in places like Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, the Balkans, the North Caucasus, and sub-Saharan Africa. Last year in Nigeria, for example, where Saudi and Gulf missionaries have long labored and spent large sums of money, an Islamist group known as Boko Haram amended its theretofore local agenda to name the United States as its number one target for, quote-unquote, America's oppression and aggression against Muslim nations, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan, and because of its blind support for Israel, close quote. More immediately dangerous for the West, however, are the Saudi regime-funded activities of its surrogate Islamist clerics in the United States and Europe, especially in the United Kingdom. For more than 30 years, the Saudis' domestic religious establishment, which controls education, social policy, and missionary work, has brought Western Muslims to the kingdom for theological training in its religious universities. These men return to the West to preach what only can be described as a martial-oriented Islamist imperialism, a vision of the world as wholly Islamic, which for the West would mean that Christian and Jewish populations could convert, accept subordination to Islam, or face elimination. These Saudi-trained preachers are prominent in mosques in the United States and in Europe, and have secured positions as chaplains in Western universities, prison systems, and militaries. This is not to say, let me stress, that all American or European Muslim communities share this martial and expansionist orientation, but it is very much to say that these Saudi-trained clerics have attained enough positions in the West and have enough access to Muslim youth through multiple media vehicles, access to Muslim youth through multiple media vehicles, to have a growing impact West in a pro-jihad direction, in much the same way they have for years influenced them in the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. Those who doubt this would be well served in reviewing the escalating number of militant-related activities that have been uncovered and stopped in the United States since 2007. To note the growing number of U.S., young U.S., Canadian, Australian, and British Muslims who are going abroad to fight and train under Al-Qaeda's banner in Somalia, Yemen, and Afghanistan, and also to note Al-Qaeda's very successful recruitment of talented U.S. citizen Muslims to run media operations targeting Muslim communities in the English-speaking world. And the Saudis, too, are the bridge from our second source of concern in the Persian Gulf, the Saudi kingdom and its brother tyrannies, to the third, namely Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, their allies, and the increasing numbers of Muslims inspired by each. When all is said and done, Osama bin Laden is not an anomaly in Saudi Arabia. Rather, he is the poster boy for its educational system's successes. Fortunately for the United States and the West, bin Laden has matured as a defensive and temperate Islamist, not like the Saudi monarchy and the Muslim Brotherhood, offensive and intolerant ones. Even with these differences, however, the Saudis' overseas missionary activities are an indispensable aid to Al-Qaeda's organizational, military, and media activities. Through expatriate Saudi preachers, Islamic NGOs, and direct funding by Riyadh for local Islamic organizations, the Saudis have created Muslim communities in most areas of the world that are alienated and even hateful, alienated from and even hateful toward the West. And so these communities are congenial environments for hosting an Al-Qaeda presence. In the Balkans, in India and Bangladesh, in the North Caucasus in South Asia, in North America in Europe, and in sub-Saharan Africa, these preachers, NGOs, and doses of Saudi cash have for decades prepared the ground for Al-Qaeda and its allies. Do the Saudis realize this? Of course they do. We must always keep in mind that the only Islamist terrorist or insurgent attack that Saudi leaders disapprove of are those that occur outside the kingdom, inside the kingdom, rather. A final point to make on the symbiotic Saudi Arabia-Al-Qaeda relationship outside the Arabian Peninsula is that Saudi activities abroad relieve Al-Qaeda of the need to fund, staff, and manage a humanitarian educational health services wing, like those that are run by Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Muslim Brotherhood. And therefore, bin Laden is allowed to focus on spreading his organization and planning military activities. Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and their allies, and those they inspire then, are the third of the Persian Gulf threats. And they are, I think, the most dangerous to the United States. They are the most dangerous not because they are more powerful than the United States, nor because they are supported by all Muslims. They are the most dangerous Gulf origin threat to America because the U.S. bipartisan governing elite has uniformly refused to accept reality. From the first Bush to Clinton to George W. Bush to Barack Obama, Americans have been told that they are at war because Al-Qaeda and its allies are motivated by hatred for our liberty, way of life, and democratic institutions. This is a palpable, lethal lie. We are being attacked because of our elite's half-century record of relentless intervention in the Muslim world. It is in the cumulative impact of 50 years of interventionism that we find the main motivation of America's Islamist enemies, as well as the principal organizational glue that provides a modicum of unity to the movement's always fragile cohesion. The Islamist motivation is to be found in their perception of U.S. foreign policy as an attack on the Islamic religion and its followers. This is a view that is held not only by those carrying AK-47s, but, if extensive polling by reliable Western pollsters is reliable, by nearly 80% of all Muslims worldwide, young and old, moderate and militant men and women. Now, no American must accept the Islamists' indictment of the anti-Muslim intent of U.S. foreign policy. But to avoid military defeat, economic ruin, and ultimately widespread domestic violence, U.S. leaders must acknowledge and then explain to Americans that this is the Muslim world's perception, and that U.S. security requires all of us to accept the hard truth that perception is always reality. And what are the policies motivating the bin Laden-inspired Islamists? I can do no better than list the six U.S. policies bin Laden enumerated in late summer 1996, and to which he has held closely for the next 15 years. I would also note that four of the six policies motivate to a greater or lesser extent our foes in Iran and Saudi Arabia. According to bin Laden, then, America's declaration of war on Islam and on Muslims is clear in the following facts. First, the U.S. military and civilian presence on the Arabian Peninsula. Second, U.S. and Western exploitation of Muslim energy resources. Third, the U.S. military presence in Muslim lands outside the peninsula. Fourth, U.S. support for nations that oppress Muslims, especially Russia, China, and India. Fifth, endless and unqualified U.S. support for Israel. Sixth, U.S. support and protection for Muslim tyrannies. Thus, it is policy, not lifestyle, that is the casus belli for the war bin Laden declared on the United States on 23 August 1996. And yet, nearly 15 years on, there has been no public contention by any serious political figure, save Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich, that the Islamists are motivated by anything more than a blind bloodlust and a cultural, political, religious hatred for America and the West. Why is such the case? Well, I believe it is because America's governing elite are addicted to interventionism. It is, sadly, their default response to international affairs. Witness, for example, Obama, Clinton, and McCain intervening on both sides in they can identify even a single genuine U.S. national interest at risk. In making this claim, I do not suggest I can read the minds or hearts of those who have for three decades designed our disastrous foreign policy in the Muslim world. Because no one has such divine insight, I take as my guide General Washington's assertion that the views of men can only be known or guessed at by their words or actions. Using this metric, our leader's pervasive, bipartisan, and doctrinaire interventionism emerges in sharp relief. U.S. intervention, then, is the Islamists' main motivation for fighting America. And while U.S. citizens can debate if the policy status quo should be kept or what or more of the policy should be amended or abandoned, maintenance of Washington's prevailing assumption that Muslims hate Americans for who they are and how they live, and not for what the U.S. government does in the Islamic world, will lead to nothing less than a vast case of self-deception, yielding eventually calamity for the nation. Indeed, the United States today may stand in a historically unique position. No other great power in my memory has faced a situation in which it is likely to be attacked at home in a manner at least as, and probably more severe, than 9/11, and have no means with which to respond to the enemy in a militarily telling manner. Having already destroyed the known infrastructure of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, we are bereft of meaningful military targets and are left with only the most likely default response: attack Iran, no matter who attacks us, or attack symbolic targets, such as population centers in Afghanistan and Pakistan, or holy places, such as Mecca or Medina. Thus, after a second attack in the United States, the choice for Washington would be one of two: either standing motionless in a quivering but impotent rage, or launching attacks that would make the late Professor Huntington's warning of a clash of civilizations all too prescient. In America today, as I think you will agree, the foregoing analysis is not mainstream. Indeed, I've often heard it dismissed as pathological. And yet, more than 14 years after Al-Qaeda declared war on the United States, the cynical act of political expediency in Iraq known as the surge is unraveling. As U.S. casualties resume, sectarian violence grows, and more elections come and go. The war in Afghanistan is lost beyond recall, and President Obama has marooned our military forces, making them dependent on resupply routes that traverse hostile Russian and Pakistani territory. Pakistan is in genuine danger of going the way of Afghanistan, with unfortunate consequences for nuclear proliferation. And the Mujahideen bleed through from Iraq is already visible in Jordan, Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, and Gaza. In addition, the Islamist insurgencies in Somalia and Algeria have been rekindled, with the Somali Mujahideen nearing victory and the Algerian insurgents spreading into West Africa. Similar insurgencies of varying but building vitality are underway in Yemen, southern Thailand, Mindanao, and the North Caucasus. The major cities of Hindu India have been attacked by Islamist fighters, and the Islamist movement in Western Europe is growing, and in Britain has driven the traditionally stoic security services to the point of public despair. As for the United States, Bin Laden long ago delineated Al-Qaeda's war aims for defeating America in three concise phrases. First, to take advantage of economic situations internationally to help lead America to bankruptcy. Second, to spread out U.S. military and intelligence forces, sap their flexibility, and exhaust their reserves. Third, to strip away America's allies and to disrupt domestic political unity in America as much as possible. I will leave it to the audience to decide, using these three war aims as the metric, whether there is any reason for Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda to be discouraged about the progress they have made in the war they began in 1996. Now let me move to discussing how we can begin to blunt the threats from the Persian Gulf. The best foreign policy advice for the Obama administration, in fact for any U.S. administration, has been heard by anyone who's flown on an airliner. During the pre-flight safety briefing, each passenger is told that in case of an emergency, place your oxygen mask on first and only then help others with theirs. I have referred to this common sense instruction in my books, and I believe in its continuing direct pertinence to U.S. foreign policy. Before America and the few of our allies who will fight, can defeat the expanding Islamist movement, and beat it we must, and unfortunately with more military power than we've used to date. Washington must put its own political and foreign policy houses in order. America can help no alliance partner or other foreign nation until it is re-anchored in its own history and tradition. Indeed, until this re-anchoring occurs, America cannot even help itself. To achieve this goal, we must return to the governing doctrine crafted by Washington and the other founders. In foreign policy, the key to re-anchoring is an approach that is more independent and less interventionist. If there be one principle more deeply rooted in the mind of every American, Jefferson wrote, 1791, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest. In America's dealings with Iran and less obviously with Saudi Arabia, as well as in its war with Islamism, we are losing because our bipartisan governing elite and its academic and media apologists have turned Mr. Jefferson's guidance on its head, much to the nation's detriment. Because of this interventionism, which the founders would have damned to hell, we as a nation are mired in an environment in the Persian Gulf region that is conducive to an endless war with Muslims. Foreign policy is at base about creating multiple options to use to protect genuine U.S. interests and independence in an always unpredictable world. But when Americans celebrate Independence Day this coming July, I would predict that neither President Obama nor Senator McCain will have the moral courage to tell Americans the truth, which is that over the past 35 years, both parties have consciously eviscerated U.S. independence on the single most important foreign policy issue, the decision about whether or not to go to war. Both parties, for example, have failed to move the United States closer to energy security since the first Saudi-led oil embargo in 1973. Instead of freeing the U.S. economy from the Arab-held dagger pointed at its heart, American presidents, Republican and Democratic, have unmanfully groveled, begged, and even publicly bowed to the tyrants of the Arabian Peninsula in their desperate quest for more oil. The same presidents, moreover, have so enormously overspent the public treasury that America is now further in the thrall of the same Arab tyrants who, with China, buy the largest part of our debt. I can only remark that there are few better definitions of abject foreign policy than one that puts U.S. energy and financial security in the hands of its enemies. Because of such leaderships, Americans find they have lost control over the peace or war decision. If anti-Saudi unrest in the kingdom's eastern province ever seriously curtailed oil production, U.S. forces will deploy there to defend and secure the Saudi police state and to restore the flow of oil. And the reality of an automatic war for oil goes beyond the Arab world. Currently, Mexico is one of our top oil suppliers and is creeping toward the status of a failed state. And by 2015, the United States will import 20% of its crude from the Niger Delta region. If production in either place, and both already advanced in insurgencies, is ever significantly reduced, U.S. soldiers and Marines almost certainly will deploy to restore production. And if you think the insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan are nightmares, wait until U.S. forces are fighting in the Niger Delta's 27,000 square kilometers of swamp and forest. As for Mexico, I can only think that our governing elite's criminal failure to enforce that indispensable component of national defense, known as effective border control, has set America up for a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions, a tragedy that when it comes will be of our own making, and one that once started will unfold rapidly and bring with it the strong possibility of significant violence in parts of the United States. Americans also have lost control of the peace or war decision because their leaders have involved them almost inextricably in the unending and unendable religious war between Arabs and Israelis. Ignoring and even ridiculing the founders' explicit guidance to avoid getting Americans involved in other people's wars, Both parties not only have involved us in this Middle East conflict, but they have involved us in other people's religious wars. Can there be any better definition of an insane foreign policy than the one that today finds the United States not only involved to the hilt in this irrelevant religious war, but politically backing and frenetically arming both of the major antagonists of the war, Israel and Saudi Arabia?
Well, we're going to stop there, but from where I sit in terms of political perspective, my limited analysis of this, I think Mr. Shore is right on target. And if he were running for some type of national office, I think I would be willing to support him. A brilliant analysis in the book. If you haven't picked it up and read it, it's entitled simply Osama Bin Laden, and he has other writings that that you could follow. And again, he does this both as an intellectual analyzing this, but he worked inside and headed up the Osama Bin Laden unit within the Central Intelligence Agency. So it's not a guy that's unversed about what's going on in that part of the world. And it seems to, I know this is awful to say about any commentator relative to world international politics, it seems sensible. Well, hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Tune in next week. We're going to have Vera Lynn sign us off tonight, as she always does, singing that beautiful song, We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.